Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is AB Dawji, and this is The Big Picture, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. First of all, I want to extend my sincere apologies to all you people in Gauteng. Yes, folks, I'm really, really sorry for laughing at you about the cold that you've been experiencing over the past few weeks. The cold has reached Durban. And I can tell you that people are walking around here looking like frozen fish fingers. And I met Koos van der Merwe, and he told me that it was so cold this morning that when he went to the ATM to draw money, it said, account frozen. And he said, Yarro boot, I'm going back later when it gets warmer, eh? Later I met Saber, and he said, hey Mamo, it's very, very cold, bro. I asked him how cold it is, expecting him to tell me what's the temperature. And he said, hey, it's so cold that I saw a lawyer with his hands in his own pocket. Anyway, it's really tough getting out from under the godras, the duvet and the blankets, eh? All piled up on you. Crawl out slowly and then make a dash for the bathroom. Let me say this. I've heard of underfloor heating, but does anyone sell heated toilet seats? Yeah, landing the helicopter slowly and nervously can be quite a traumatic experience, eh? And when you reach inside the shower to turn the water on, how fast you pull your arm away as the freezing water stabs you like sharp needles. And then you wait a while for the hot water to emerge. Lots of water wasted as you wait. More water than what some people in the squatter camps down the road have for a day. Which brings me to the point. Can you imagine for a moment what it must be like in a jondol in these freezing times, eh? The gaps in the wood and tin and plastic structures that let in the biting cold, drafts of ice cold coming in. It's so difficult to imagine how people cope, especially the kids. No electricity, no heating. And you know, it's around now in winter that it's time for the flu. And how do they get hot water to wash? You know, just thinking about how they manage to cope with the cold sends a cold shiver down my back. And as you drive past, my dear people, make dua for them. Or better still, buy some blankets, eh, and just drop it off. Drop it off there. Habibi, warm their bodies and your heart will be warmed. I guarantee you that. And plan, please, 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 put aside that mindset. Hey, they're looted, so let them suffer. Ay, 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 ay. Don't paint everyone with the same brush, okay? And if any of them did loot, well, let me put it this way. It didn't make them as fortunate as you are. They still live in a tin structure that lets in the cold. And when you look at the big picture, count your blessings, Habibi. Count your blessings. Make shukr for your warm bed, your lovely steaming shower, and your hot breakfast. And speaking about the weather, in Europe at the moment, it's steaming hot with temperatures exceeding 30 degrees. Right, so Norway's female beach handball team was taking part against Spain at a European Championship match in Bulgaria. The Norwegian team was fined £1,300, that's about 26,000 rands, for being improperly dressed. Yes, folks, they were not properly dressed. What were they wearing while playing the game? Good heavens. Good heavens. Unbelievable. Shocking, shocking, shocking. They were wearing shorts. Very tight shorts. That's right, people. Inappropriately dressed for the match, therefore a £1,300 fine. So what should they have been wearing? And the answer is bikinis. That's right, bikinis. That was the appropriate dress required. I don't know. I don't know if you can believe that, Habibi. Tight shorts bad, bikinis good. Conforming to the athletic uniform regulations. You know, I don't know what this thing called Western values is all about. Headscarves and modest dressing is unacceptable, but walking around half naked is absolutely fine. Well, on that issue, as I said, shocking. And the Norwegian sports minister described this fine as, in his words, completely ridiculous. Well, for me, another shock was to discover that the name of Norway's Minister of Culture and Sports, right? Norway's Minister of Culture and Sports is Abid Raja. That's right, you heard right. Abid Raja, a Muslim. His name is actually Abid Kayum Raja. I was so surprised that I went to Wikipedia, Googled it, to find out about him. And there, dear listeners, I found a fascinating story of his life. Absolutely incredible. I don't have time to read it all to you, but I urge you to go to Wikipedia. Just Google the name Abid Raja, or you can also Google Norway's Minister of Culture and Sports. And through a very difficult childhood, his parents were Pakistani, and they were very violent parents. And he had a stay at an orphanage and so on. And, well, he cast all that aside and straightened out his life and became more determined. And eventually, he studied and became a lawyer. He studied at the University of Oxford, University of Oslo, and University of Southampton. He is 46 years old and married to Nadia Ansar. And they have three children. Just go and Google him. Fascinating story about Abid, Abid Raja, Norway's Minister of Culture and Sports. Oh yes, I made one more startling discovery. Startling discovery. Do you know who is Lina Khan? Lina Khan? Of course you don't. I only discovered her a few days ago. She is the youngest person and the first Muslim in U.S. history to become the chair of the United States Federal Trade Commission. That's the FTC. She's just 32 years old. She's just 32 years old and is the Associate Professor of Law. She is the Associate Professor of Law. Sorry, I just got distracted there. She's at Columbia University, but at the moment she's on leave while at her new job. She was appointed to as chair of the Federal Trade Commission, or the FTC, as I told you, by President Joe Biden in June this year. Two multi-billion dollar companies that you know very well, Amazon and Facebook, are totally scared of her. Petrified, yes. Why? Because the FTC checks if a company is so big that it has a monopoly in the economy, so that competition has no choice, smaller businesses and so on. So there's no chance for them to compete with this big organization or big company. So Lina Khan has her sights on Amazon and Facebook, and they are, to put it mildly, suffering from bouts. Well, in medical terms, chronic julab. Born in London of Pakistani parents, they all, of course, moved to the United States when she was 11 years old, and so began an illustrious career, graduating as a lawyer from Yale University and Columbia Law School. She's married to Shah Ali, who is a cardiologist. And, of course, just Google her. Another fascinating story. Lina, L-I-N-A, Khan, K-H-A-N. So there you are, folks. Fascinating lives of two Muslim lawyers. What an absolute delight in a world tainted by rabid Islamophobia. Yes, folks, my flabber is absolutely ghasted. I have been equally fascinated and very proud of the achievements of another lawyer. In fact, an internationally renowned and recognized jurist. And this lady is from Durban. Yeah, from Durban, I'll have you know. Her name is Dr. Navi Pillay. She served as the United Nations High head of the United Nations High Commission from 2008 to 2014. She was, according to Wikipedia, the first non-white woman judge of the High Court of South Africa. And she also served as a judge of the International Criminal Court from and she was the president of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. We'll speak to her shortly, but first, let me say that this sprightly lady with a sharp brain had no time to relax when she returned to Durban. The United Nations Human Rights Council has just announced that Dr. Navi Pillay would head a three-person investigation into the alleged violations of international humanitarian law and all alleged violations and abuses of international human rights law in Israel, East Jerusalem, the West Bank and Gaza. Well, I won't tell you more about that. Here's what it's all about as reported on an international news channel. Let me just play you the clip.
All right, so let's start with the big story that we are tracking on Beyond at this hour, where former United Nations Rights Chief Navi Pillay will be leading the United Nations open-ended inquiry into systematic abuses in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now, Pillay will be leading a three-person investigation that is intended to examine abuses and also their root causes in the decades-long conflict. The probe was triggered during a special session of the council which focused on the deadly violence that was inflicted in the Palestinian territories that escalated in the month of May. A commission of inquiry is in fact the highest level investigation that can be ordered by the Human Rights Council, and the commission is tasked with investigating all alleged violations of international human rights. It'll also be probing all underlying root causes for the recurrent tensions, instability and the protracted nature of the conflict, including the systematic discrimination that is subjected to on the people in the Palestinian territories. The team will also be examining the facts and circumstances surrounding the violations and will identify those who are responsible in order to ensure that they are held accountable. The commission will report to the Human Rights Council each year from the 22nd of June. But this commission is the first ever open-ended commission of inquiry. Other such commissions need their mandates renewed every year. And the commission was ordered after the violence escalated between Israel and the Palestinian territories in the month of May. But remember, for 11 straight days, the tiny state of Israel carried out relentless bombings and airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, and also Hamas fighters fired rockets towards the Israeli cities. It is estimated that about 250 Palestinians were killed in the bombings, while 13 Israelis were also killed in the counterfire. Israel has rejected this United Nations resolution, this United Nations Human Rights Council, and has said that it will not cooperate into this international probe on violations of human rights in the territories that it governs. Pillay, a South African former judge, served as the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights from 2008 till 2014. And she'll be joined by Milun Kothari of India, the first United Nations Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, and also Australian International Human Rights Law expert Chris Sidotti.
Okay, folks, well, there you are. You heard it all on the clip. And now it is a great privilege and honor for me to speak to a brilliant lady that makes South Africa very proud indeed. Dr. Navi Pillay, welcome to the Big Picture program.
Oh, thank you very much, Adil, very kind of you to call me. You know, I think it's so important that you are providing information to listeners about
this. And thank you very much for coming on at short notice. And you are speaking to AB.
AB, okay, that's even better then.
Right, so I won't ask you about your new position, as I believe that you still have to be briefed about the details of the task before you. So, now, you are a woman of many firsts, opening your own law firm and attending Harvard University. You are also an expert in international criminal law. What is one of the highlights of such an illustrious career?
Oh, wow. Thank you for that question. You know, I've been working for more than 50 years, so there are many, but you speak about the first. Here in South Africa, I am very pleased of all the efforts I made that resulted in long-term public service, that made a difference in people's lives. And internationally, they don't know that I had been doing that for 30 years in South Africa. One is exposing the torture that used to take place during the apartheid era, detentions by the security police, the murder of the Imam of Cape Town, the murder of Ahmed Timol, just to name a few, my own husband's detention. So I felt it was very important that I had the opportunity in one of our cases, Harry Gwala ANC trial, to expose the torture conducted by the chief of the security police. Now, all those affidavits that we brought out were eventually used in the UN by the anti-apartheid movement, and they motivated for a convention against torture. So that's the most important convention that the UN has adopted in addressing torture. So sometimes you do a little act here, and you don't see the long-term effects. The importance of that is we have to try to do something. Yeah, and the other is the application I made for Robben Island prisoners that benefited everybody, including Nelson Mandela. They finally knew their rights, and ill treatment was stopped there. So that benefits all inmates in our country. I'm pleased with the first like that. Thank you for asking me.
Right. Let's go on to more of your achievements thereafter.
Well, you know, what I'm really known for is when I served as a judge and president of the International Tribunal for Rwanda, where we were hearing genocide cases. The court was in Tanzania. I served there for 8.5 years. I never planned that. I was elected by the General Assembly after President Mandela nominated me. I thought I'd serve for 1 year and come back, but I served there for 8.5 years. So the milestone judgments there are recognized as the very first in the world. The one was we recognize rape and sexual violence as constituting genocide and crimes against humanity. Now, before that, what happened to women in conflicts and wars, and particularly sexual violence, rape, and so on. In our case, it's rape and sexual violence against men and women. And it was never prosecuted before at all, not even in Nuremberg. So these are the first prosecutions, and it was quite a challenge to write those judgments, create a new definition so that what happens to men during war, where they are subjected to sexual violence, is also treated seriously. The other is what they call the media decision. That's also a very first, spelling out freedom of speech and the responsibility of media as well, and hate speech. You mentioned Islamophobia. I have spoken out against Islamophobia, xenophobia, homophobia, hate speech, and racial prejudice that sometimes is at the root of these wars and conflicts.
And how was your stay in Rwanda itself?
When we first went, there were no roads, there was no bank, no supermarket. There was no bank. So the UN registrar flew in the cash from Nairobi and paid us in cash, words of dollars. And very often some of these dollar notes were forged, but there's no bank, so we couldn't get a replacement of these notes. So that went on, I would say, for the first 6 months. But when the first supermarket was open, I think it was ShopRite, it was like almost a day off for all of us, so we can go and shop there. I used to take, cartons of milk, margarine for the Russian judge, vitamins for somebody else. I used to take them from Durban. And there were no roads. It was all very rural. But, you know, we really came to love the place because the people were just so pleasant, so kind and tolerant. I got to know the Indian community there as well. They owned coffee plantations. They had invited me to join the club, the golf course. So very hospitable. It made up for everything. We all came to love the place. It was rural, just at the foothills of Mount Meru and Kilimanjaro.
Right, so you were the judge president of the United Nations Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda.
Yes.
And as I read about you, that you were also at Harvard. What was it like going to Harvard and getting a doctorate there during the 80s as a black woman from apartheid South Africa?
Yes, you know, I went to Robben Island to visit Harry Gawler and the others, and we were so disappointed that they had been convicted on evidence that was tainted by torture. So they put the idea in my head to go overseas and speak about this case. So first I got a scholarship. It was a scholarship only for black South Africans, and I went and did my master's. I came back, continued as a lawyer here, and saved money, and 4 years later I applied to do the doctorate. I heard that Harvard only takes about 7 students from the whole world, so I was very lucky to get in. And my experience there was, I think it's because I was already an experienced lawyer that I was able to cope. Otherwise, the education is really fast-paced. All those students have scored like over 99% to be selected to go there. So that's the one level. The others are, they were all rich students. They were children of very, very rich people or politicians and ministers. And there I was, a daughter of a bus driver. It was very strange. And on top of that, I had my 2 daughters with me. I think it was because of our struggle in South Africa, where we learned to speak up, demand, address issues of racism, even though rich people overseas were very uncomfortable about the fact that they benefited from colonizing Africa. So all these issues we learned in South Africa to ask questions. And I think that that's what helped me. The first time I opened my voice in a big classroom there, all those students turned around to stare at me, you know, really like seeing a black woman and speaking without an accent. In fact, they said, at the library, some people said to me, "Oh, you speak English very well. Is it because you've been in the United States for a long time?" And I said, "No, it's because I've not been in the United States for a long time that I speak well." South African experience, I put it down to.
Right. In case you just joined us, listeners, you are listening to the eminent jurist, Dr. Navi Pillay. Now, Dr. Pillay, I want you to take me back to a young girl on the streets of Clarewood in Durban.
Well, I don't think there are very many people alive of my age on how we grew up in Clarewood. Firstly, it was a mixed community. So it was not only all race groups, but all sections of the Indian community. So you were just neighbors. It didn't matter whether you Muslim, Hindu, Christian, whatever. We went into the churches and the mosques. I think I benefited from that. It was an extremely poor area, but there were several schools. And I know that a lot of activity used to go on. People used to come in and hold meetings and share pamphlets and so on, but we were not allowed to do that. You know how strictly girls were brought up in Indian homes, so we were not allowed to go and attend any of these. However, what was very active in that community are speech contests, gymnastic contests. I love that a community got together. The most important thing they did for me, the poor people of community, is that they collected money and sent me to university, because the high school, Claude High School, principal and teachers told the community, we have a girl here with potential. She should go to university. Years later, I met the community. I feel they placed a trust in me, and I feel that I enjoy, not only enjoy, but voluntarily serve the public. This is the trust they placed in me when they collected the money to send me to university. It's not to boost my career. So I'm very pleased now you mentioned, AB, this commission. Yes, you know, the UN commissions, unlike the commissions that are held here in South Africa, the UN doesn't have the funds to pay commissioners. So this is entirely pro bono and a public service. But it's also a deep honor, a very deep honor to be selected to serve on these commissions.
Yes,
and
most
so
certainly.
So I'm continuing. That's what I feel good about. I could look into the eyes of the people, the children of the residents of Clarewood who sent me to university, to say, well, there you are, I'm still answering the call. It's not only a responsibility, especially in a very important situation like this that affects human rights of people. So thank you very much for focusing on this work. You're quite right. I don't know the details yet, so I can't talk about the work we will be doing.
Okay. Now, you're a judge and also a human rights activist. Some of the work that you've done is criticizing countries and their leaders for human rights abuses. How do you cope with the backlash?
Oh, well, you're quite right. There were many backlashes and threats. So you really hit the nail on the head about the challenges of being a High Commissioner for Human Rights. And you're right, because it's very political to criticize a country on their human rights record. They like you to criticize their enemies, but not to criticize themselves or their friends. They don't want you to look into their own backyards, for instance, in Switzerland or Germany or in Europe, on how they treat migrants, especially migrants from Africa, the racist attitudes towards them, and the fact that they don't get citizenship. Now, of course, the United Nations created this post of High Commissioner for Human Rights because civil society, ordinary people, demanded it, because they wanted governments to be more accountable and to protect the human rights of their own citizens and the citizens of the world. So many people told me it's a very difficult job, you shouldn't take it on, but it's a great honor and responsibility. And I always worked very closely with ordinary people all over the world. I spoke with heads of state and governments on about 79 country visits. I also spoke with NGOs in each country. So then you get to know exactly what the challenges are on the ground. As South Africans here will tell you, but sometimes the picture painted by governments is not realistic. I found in my own office, for instance, and many ambassadors, especially from developing countries, pointed it out to me, that almost all the staff were from Western countries. We had like 10 offices in Africa, in you know, offices all over the world, but the offices in Africa, I'm just singling out, was not headed by a black person, not a single office. Mm. And not a single one was headed by a woman or a black woman. And this is what I tried to change. I said to the council at one of these sessions where we discussed the geographical composition of the staff, I said, I will not tolerate apartheid in my office. I'm going to do something about it, which I tried to do immediately because there were such capable people. How come they were passed over just because of the color of their skin? So I think because of our South African experience, we notice this. We notice when racism is being practiced, and yet it seems to be invisible to those practicing these racial discriminatory appointments and so on.
Right. Now, on a personal note,
yeah,
does being a powerful judge make you a powerful mum and grandma?
I wish that was the position. You know, as my children were growing up, they couldn't be bothered whether I was a lawyer or busy with major cases. As soon as I entered the home, at the end of the day, the first question is, what's for lunch? Mommy, we are hungry. So you are a mother first and foremost. I think that a mother who is educated definitely is in a better position to bring up your children, to get them to think independently, and to give them the love and attention that they need. I believe that's the truest joy, the joy of children and grandchildren. I have two grandchildren. One is a boy who was born in New York, and he's still there, and the other is a baby. A newborn baby. So children and grandchildren are very important to me. But let me tell you, Amy, you see, we are disadvantaged because these young children know much more about the computer and the electronic world. So they get very impatient when you ask them, how do I do this? You know, what happened here? So they become the parents instructing you on the new media. So nevertheless, let me say, we all know being a parent is the greatest joy. It's also challenging because you have to guide them in life. I find many, many parents with young children extremely worried about living in South Africa and what, especially people from the minority communities. What are the prospects for their children? Now, these are realistic concerns. And they asked me this because I've been staying out of the country overseas for 20 years. Well, the grass is not greener anywhere else. You've come across other problems elsewhere. I think that we have a lovely, beautiful country with beautiful weather, maybe not today, but many things to enjoy here.
Yes.
Mainly the community spirit, I would say.
Absolutely, because, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Navi Pillay, we are proud of your achievements in the fight for human rights and in the arena of international law. We wish you all the best in your new position, no doubt an extremely tough one, and we pray that you are safe on your travels, and may you have a long life in pursuit of justice for the oppressed people of the world. Thank you once again for giving us your time.
Thank you. That's a lovely message, lovely greeting. I truly appreciate that. Thank you very much. And thank you to listeners. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye-bye. Right. There you are. Wonderful lady. Now, we don't have much time. Let me now move to the hot topic that has been dominating the headlines in the post-looting period, post-looting, after the looting, and that is Phoenix. Here's something that you may know. The word Phoenix, well, where does it come from? A phoenix is a mythical bird known for rising from its ashes. According to ancient legend, the phoenix is a bird that in cycles burns to death and is reborn from its own ashes. For this reason, the phoenix often serves as a symbol of renewal and rebirth. Right? Let me repeat the last part. For this reason, the phoenix often serves as a symbol of renewal and rebirth. Well, folks, I really hope, inshallah, that the trauma that Phoenix and the surrounding areas have suffered will result in a renewal and rebirth, a new era of peace and harmony with no racial tensions and discord. Now, let me say something very concisely and very clearly. Succinct is the word I'm looking for. And please try not to misunderstand what I'm saying. Okay, Mamu? So, firstly, it was perfectly understandable for committees to set up roadblocks to protect their properties because the government failed to provide security. Right, you got that. Secondly, and this is the important part, while working hard to stop the looters, a few chaps went way beyond what was acceptable and attacked innocent black people who approached the roadblocks. Again, let me emphasize innocent blacks. Abused them, shot them, killed them for no reason at all. Sorry. That, dear listeners, is not at all acceptable. Defensive is fine. Offensive is wrong. That, according to many reports, is what happened in Phoenix. And that is why the failure of the government and the looting is not the main focus. The main focus is the killing of innocent people. And black people across the country are extremely angry. Well, how do I know? Well, I listen to radio talk shows regarded as the place where the nation is at conversation with itself. And black people are often, one after the other, have been calling in to the radio station and expressing strong sentiments about killings in Phoenix and some strong words bordering on hate speech like, go back to India. Everyone should be horrified with what happened in Phoenix. Blacks, Indians, whites, coloreds, everyone, because it was criminal, the part of the killing of innocent people. Yes, I know that Indian businesses were looted and destroyed and all other things that were done to you. But right now, the only thing, as I said, is the fire that is raging and getting worse. And that is the anti-Indian feelings, and that must be addressed and reduced and put out, that fire. What is absent on these talk shows is the Indian voice. The lack of engagement by us will one day come back to bite us if we leave the impression that all Indians are racist because of the killings of the innocent black people in Phoenix. Black people need to hear this. They need to hear this. We distance ourselves, we Indians distance ourselves and strongly condemn the killings of innocent black people and the burnings of their cars. The criminals who carried out these terrible acts should be arrested immediately. That, dear listeners, may in some way cool the anger of the black people. Yes. I fully understand that you too are very angry and pained. But that was about the heat and fire at that time over the 5 days. Now we have a new scenario, new fires that have the potential to burn you very badly. So let's not have an ostrich mentality, okay? And so listen and think very carefully to what I'm saying. And don't look as I said before, for something to criticize me. Okay, Habibi, the most exercise that many people get is getting on their high horses or jumping to conclusion. Call into the radio stations, right? 702 SAFM and many others, and let black people hear your voice. As Nike would say, just do it. And Phoenix will rise again, flying into a bright new day of peace and harmony. Right, and let me quickly also take the opportunity of thanking all those wonderful people from Gauteng who have sent truckloads of food to KZN. And I think they also loaded a lot of freezing cold weather and sent it down here. And also our local chaps here who did sterling work in providing food and distributing it all over. Right, now time is running out, so enough of that. And let me go to another burning issue. I discussed a burning issue. And now to a cooler item, and that is ice cream. Guess what? One of the strongest countries in the world, Israel, is waging war on ice cream. That's right. Yes, folks, Israel finished bombing Gaza. It is now attacking ice cream. Hey, Mota, why are you raising your eyebrow, eh? Wondering what I smoked. Let me explain. Under continuous pressure from BDS, that's a boycott, divestment and sanctions movement against Israel, the world-famous ice cream company Ben & Jerry announced that it would stop selling its ice cream in the occupied Palestinian territories, that is the West Bank, Gaza and East Jerusalem. Yes, of course, this means that it will still be sold in Israel itself. And Israel is very, very cross at this move. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that Israel will act aggressively against the company. I can just imagine that he must have said something like Salobin and Jerry. Even Netanyahu himself tweeted, "Now we Israelis know which ice cream not to buy." Well, shame. Poor fellow is facing corruption charges, including using public money on ice cream. That's £1,700, equals to 35,000 rands. And that was translating to 14 kilos of ice cream per month. That's what they were buying, the family was buying. That's a lot of ice cream to eat. Ach, shame, eh? But guess what? Since the call went out to boycott Ben & Jerry, the company reported on Thursday that its sales went up by 21%. 21%. Very strange, eh? But Israel is at war, and I won't tell you what it's doing. It's got a special app mobilizing people against it and getting American states to act against Ben and Jerry because they've passed many anti-BDS laws. Now, very quickly, I want to touch on this subject, also about where Israel is involved. And this is bad news for Israel. And it's called Pegasus. You must have heard about it. It's not... if you haven't heard about it, Pegasus is an app, right? Like what you have on your cell phone, like Smart Bilal or the Uber app or WhatsApp and so on. Pegasus is ancient mythology. In ancient mythology, is a winged horse. A winged horse. Hey, I told you about Phoenix and now Pegasus. Who said that the big picture is not an educational program? Hey, Mamu. So, like a winged horse, more like a Trojan horse, it flies through the air to infect your phones. So this app was developed by an Israeli company called NSO, and the app was sold to many governments around the world. Usually you have to look for an app that you want, like Uber and so on, and then you yourself download it onto your phone. You decide. With the Pegasus app, any government anywhere in the world can install the app onto your phone secretly, and you won't even know that it's there. You can't trace it or get rid of it. Whoa, crazy, right? So, what does this app do? Well, it's known as spyware. It gives information to people who sent it to your phone. It can quietly put your camera on, your microphone on. It can see all your messages, all your photos that you have, your location, where you are via GPS. It can get all your passwords and listen and record all your calls. In other words, someone thousands of miles away can do what you do with your phone. They can get into your phone. Scary, okay? According to the Guardian newspaper, thousands of phones around the world have been infected with the Pegasus app. I just want the radio station just to allow me a minute or two before they broadcast the news. So the Pegasus app has infected also 14 world leaders. Hey, you know what? Our President Cyril Ramaphosa, his phone is infected. And also France's President Emmanuel Macron and Pakistan's Imran Khan. What is worrying is that governments could have used this app against opponents, and including human rights activists. There is a claim that the Saudis used the app to spy on Jamal Khashoggi and his friends, whose phones were found to be infected. Amnesty International has traced Pegasus on the phones of 40 human rights activists and journalists and lawyers. As you can imagine, people around the world are very, very cross, and the finger is pointed at Israel that it okayed the sale of this app to oppressive regimes. Big story, Habibi, unfolding. Watch it very closely. You know, I just got news that Israel loaded the app onto the phone of a fellow from Durban and is struggling to interpret what he is saying. Ronnie is speaking to his friend Gulamba, and the conversation went something like this, and Israel picked it up. Except, bra, what I must tune you, eh? My fro made lakka, meti bhaji and all. My bali and I and Ganes, we caught a thick chow. Later, the topi and me were shut and caught a killer dos. My chomi came to my posi and we vied to check the other bras in chassis. These oaks were sending the zol, not me. We were tuning and tuning. Some lani oaks were there also. Mamus, except mamus, eh? Lakka time. They oaks were dopping heavy stuff. Me only mineral. Hey, the Tani is calling right now. Hey, I got to fire. Okay, check you, Brazo. Okay, lakka, lakka, lakka. Ciao, bro. So, dear listeners, the Israelis will have a tough time trying to interpret that, especially the reference to bra. This is Abi Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.